Okay, the results are in. Sam got 10 votes and Sally got 15 votes. So Sally is our new class president.
Hold on, kids. We're using the Electoral College system today, and that means that Sally doesn't win. Sam, you're the winner.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Under the Electoral College system for president, the real winner doesn't always win. Support the National Popular Vote Initiative, because the winner should win.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. And where we have been, John, it's been really, really cold. And you generally need 3 layers of clothing. But today, we need 1 article of clothing, and you've got it on top of your head already. I call it a thinking cap.
The thinking cap.
Yeah, right. No, you do. This is going to be one that's going to have you really scratching your head and puzzling a little bit over how do I really feel about this? And I'm going to boil it down for you, John. A very simple question, and I know you'll have an answer to this. Is there a better way to elect a president?
I don't know. I kind of like the system we have now. I mean, because our forefathers didn't trust anybody. And so at least it gave us an out if we did have somebody that to be good for the nation.
So you mean the Electoral College.
Right.
And by the way, a lot of people don't want to close the Electoral College because, well, do you want your alma mater closed or shuttered? What happens to their sports teams? Oh, it's not a real college, John? Or is it?
I guess it is.
Where's it located?
I don't know.
Well,
probably in D.C.
The Electoral College is something that, again, in a way, the electors were given a wide berth, in a sense, because states could make their own rules as to who they were sending to the Electoral College. I know a lot of people think that the founders and the Constitution are very explicit about what goes on there. But in fact, they gave a good deal of leeway. That's the first thing that I learned about the Electoral College.
But I think at least it gives, if it works properly.
Another fail safe
to the election, yes.
Well, a lot of people would like to see a national popular vote. And the reason they'd like to see that, John, is because they say, well, look at the last election and previous elections, not just Donald Trump's election, and he lost by 3 million votes in America. So is that really the consensus of the American people that he be president?
Well, but he played to the electoral states, which...
Okay, so his argument is, and I think you're wondering about it, and maybe it's legitimate, that had he not played the game the way the game was structured, then he would have spent more time in New York and California, and he would have bumped up those totals, and he would have played it in a totally different fashion.
Right, exactly. I mean, you play the game the way the game is played, right? You know,
well, absolutely. I mean, you do. I mean, if you're going to win. And that's why a lot of people said, well, Hillary Clinton should have known that she had some real difficulties and frailties in the Midwest or in Western Pennsylvania. She should have spent more time there. But now we're all trying to grapple with this issue. Well, is this system, which was meant to protect big states and small states, and really our federal system, is it still the best way in an era of modern mass and specialized communication? Shouldn't we just open it up and say, let's have a popular vote?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still pondering that.
I think a lot of people are.
I know this isn't on today's, but I kind of would like to see a better way to elect, you know, the whole election process is done. You know, I think we really don't have an opportunity to see a lot of the candidates, to hear a lot of the candidates. A lot of them are left out.
So why has that happened?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm asking you, like, for example, these folks today, the way the system has come down, and of course, it has morphed a lot over time. But right now, they pay attention, the presidential campaigns, only to about 8 states.
Right.
Now, you really begin to wonder, well, what about the rest of us? Why are we taken for granted? And if we did change the way we do this system where it's not winner take all, but every vote within every district does count, would that change the way they traverse the country and pay attention to all of us?
Or would they just concentrate on the big states?
Ah, see, that is a question that a lot of people ask.
That is the question.
Well, I've got to tell you, John, there is this National Popular Vote Initiative, and I know you've heard of it, and a lot of state legislatures have already signed on. Now, not a number amassing to 270 electoral votes, because that's a magic number. That's the number to elect a president. So they say the states that have already signed on, and I think there are about 10 or 11 that have done so. Maybe I have the number just a little low or a little high. But the point is that once we get to that point, they're ready to sign an agreement, a compact, that says we will go wherever the national popular vote goes. So even in a state like ours, if we didn't vote for that candidate, but we were part of the compact, then we would have to throw our electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote without ever changing the Constitution. What do you think of that?
I don't know. I'm still up in the air because there were reasons that this was designed this way, and I don't know, are they still valid today? That's what I'd have to think about.
Well, we were going to talk about this issue, and we are, with Drew Penrose. He is the legal whiz for fairvote.org, and that's a group that monitors and they advocate for electoral reforms in America. And our conversation really starts with how we even get into the primary system and that entire process, but then we quickly get into this issue of how it is that we actually count the votes for president. Now, we don't deal with a lot of the other areas, but you can get that on other podcasts of ours, like gerrymandering in terms of congressional districts. We've got a wonderful segment up on that with another representative from Fair Vote. And so these are really important issues. And I think as a result of the last election, a lot of people are asking, can we do something? Should we do something a little bit different than what we've been doing?
I think we need to shorten the time. These years and years for this thing to drag out just mind-boggling.
Yeah, you really begin to wonder whether this marathon that we ask these folks to run really proves anything about their steadiness, their capability. You really have to wonder about that. And why America needs this 2-year cycle. Well, let's talk about all of that with Drew Penrose, again, from fairvote.org.
Well, on with us from the group called Fair Vote is Drew Penrose. And Drew, why don't you tell us what Fair Vote is all about before we start our conversation about the National Popular Vote Movement?
Sure. So FairVote is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. We're a champion of a number of electoral reforms that give voters greater choice, a stronger voice, and a representative democracy that works for all Americans. So that's sort of a short tagline for what our values are. Some of the reforms that we work on were perhaps best known for promoting ranked choice voting and American forms of proportional voting. But as we'll talk about today, we also are endorsers of the National Popular Vote Plan for the election of the president.
Well, let's talk about the presidency and the way we go about the process. But I want to go back a little bit further in the process, because before we tally up the votes and how we do that, the question of whether our campaigns, as you folks see it, is really the best way. I mean, it seems like a long, drawn-out process. And when we look at Iowa and New Hampshire, I mean, does Fair Vote take any position on whether the primary system that we've established is just too long in the making and too difficult, cumbersome? Are there ways that we should reform that?
The presidential primary system, it certainly has a number of problems associated with it. So you mentioned the campaign period of time. That is something that could be compacted. One of the more serious issues, as I see it, is that primaries tend to attract huge fields of candidates, and we saw this especially with the Republicans in 2016. Good chance we're going to see it with the Democrats in 2020, where it's very difficult for voters to know how to vote honestly. Candidates are dropping out frequently, which can also mean that if you vote early, you might find that your vote is counting for a candidate that isn't even in the race anymore by the time your vote gets counted. And one of the reforms that I mentioned earlier can really do a lot to address that, which is ranked choice voting. If you use ranked choice voting in a primary election, you can rank the candidates, and then if your first choice drops out of the race, or if your first choice doesn't have enough votes to, say, earn any delegates from the particular state, then your ballot can count for your second choice instead. And we did some polling during the 2016 primary of Republican voters and saw that if voters had the opportunity to rank their candidates, there's a lot you can learn from that. It very well may have changed the primary outcome in some of the states, and it would have helped a lot of people whose votes were effectively, you know, thrown out in some sense because they voted for candidates who had dropped out by the time of Election Day.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
B7.
Hold on, folks. We're using the Electoral College system today, and that means the winner doesn't always win.
Congratulations, Marvin. Come on up.
But I got bingo.
Under the Electoral College system for president, the real winner doesn't always win. Support the National Popular Vote Initiative, because the winner should win.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
Would it be helpful to have more regional primaries where the Northeast votes in some collective and the Southwest or whatever, so that people see that if they can really focus on a region for a shorter period of time and they can travel more freely because it's within certain boundaries, that maybe we can make this thing a little less time consuming? I mean, I don't know what we prove by showing that people can show up all across the country for 2 years. I'm not certain exactly what that proves about leadership.
Yeah, there are a number of different proposals for changing it, and FairVote doesn't have one that it has actually endorsed at this point. One that we have looked at quite a bit, though, which holds a lot of promise, is often just called the American Plan. And it's one where you take the number of electors that a state has, and you randomize the ones that have small numbers of electors, and they go first. And then you randomize the ones that have the next higher set of electors, and they go first as well. So that way you don't know in advance which state is going to come up first or which state is going to come up later. But you still get that dynamic of having smaller states collectively going first and then larger and larger states going after. You could also consider the idea of a national primary. One thing that I often find interesting is that we do this state-by-state process for the presidential primary, mm-hmm. but no state seems interested in adopting a process like that for the election of its governor, which kind of suggests to me that maybe some of this whole state-by-state process is a little bit of a relic of the past. I mean, you're voting for delegates who then go to a state convention to nominate a candidate. The way ordinarily nominations are done is in a single primary election. We still like the idea of having that regional vote first, though. So some combination of the two is something that could be possible.
Are you thinking about a lottery of some sort so that it's not always Iowa and New Hampshire or even a blend of New Hampshire and other small states, but it could be, as you say, randomly done? How would you see that being accomplished?
Well, the way the American plan would do it, and I'm sorry, I don't have the exact numbers at my fingertips, but it's something like states whose electoral votes add up to 20 or something like that. Mm-hmm. You do a random selection of all of the states that have fewer than 20 electoral votes until you get above 20. And those go first. And that's going to be some of the small states, but not all of them. And you don't know which ones. And it is sort of a lottery process. Then you would do it again, but for states that add up to, say, 30 or 40 or something like that. And you repeat that process so you can see how the small states are largely going to go first, the larger states are largely going to go last, but you actually don't know which specific states are going to go in.
Before we get into the Electoral College versus perhaps the national popular vote, are there any other reforms that Fair Vote has looked at as it relates to presidential campaigns, and we just talked about the primaries, that you think are really important? I mean, campaign finance is always important, but that seems to be almost intractable in terms of trying to get it through without some kind of judicial review that strikes one thing or another down. But what would you see? Is there anything else before we get to how it is that we divvy up the vote?
Well, I mentioned the idea of incorporating ranked choice voting into the process, and that's really the one that we are most enthusiastically in support of. When we looked at the Republican primary, what we saw was that the Republican primary especially, because the Republican primaries, many of them are winner-take-all, meaning that a single candidate, often it was Donald Trump, would have more votes than any of the other candidates, but he would only have somewhere between 30 and 40% of the votes in the primary. It really leads to questions as to whether he, in fact, was the most representative candidate of Republicans in the primary process. Not saying that the result would have been any different under ranked choice voting, but it would have really helped to clarify exactly what level of support the various candidates had. That sort of thing would have been really helpful for Republicans in 2016, and I feel pretty strongly that it would be very helpful for Democrats going into 2020.
All right. Well, let's talk about this national popular vote. And I think folks who are listening from around the country will recognize that perhaps their state legislature has grappled with this or not. Why don't you define what it is, the national popular vote, what its intentions are, and whether it truly replaces the system we have today of the votes of the Electoral College and the way that we apportion those votes and finally decide on who the winning candidate is, regardless of the national popular vote.
Sure. So the National Popular Vote Bill would guarantee the presidency to the candidate who receives the most popular votes in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. It is not a constitutional amendment. It does not abolish the Electoral College. It's actually state legislation. So the way that this works is that the Constitution gives states free rein to assign their electoral votes however they want. In fact, historically, some states didn't even hold elections. The state legislature just picked which candidate or which electors would be chosen.
And Drew, let's back up on that for a moment, because I think a lot of people are going to be surprised to hear you say, because everybody thinks it's generally, even though there are a couple of states that don't do it this way, that it's all still today winner-take-all, and that's always been the case. But that hasn't been the case. In fact, we've changed our system of determining a president many times in the early days of our founding.
That's right. The winner-take-all system is the norm in states today, but that's largely because of the incentives to put it in place, not even because anyone actually likes the system all that much. In fact, James Madison introduced a constitutional amendment that would have made it illegal early in the United States history. That amendment obviously did not pass. But a state has incentives to award electors on a winner-take-all basis because the majority party typically controls the state legislature. The majority party wants their nominee to win most of the electors in the state, all of the electors in the state, and it's very easy for them to set it up so that they will. Now, no state today would abolish the election itself. That wouldn't be something that people would accept.
And give it back to a legislature.
Right.
It
would be constitutional. It would be allowed. It's something states have done before, but there's no way people would accept that as a possibility. But the next best thing that they can get is to award the electors on a winner-take-all basis so that their candidate will be the one that gets all of the electoral votes in the state. The downside of that, of course, is that their state will not be competitive. The presidential candidates will be unlikely to hold any campaign events there unless the state is one that's so closely divided that the candidates actually think they can flip it and have it go to the opposite candidate. And of course, we're familiar with that dynamic from presidential elections. There are somewhere between 8 and 10 swing states, right? Sometimes the number will go as high as 11 or 12, but a very small number of swing states where all of the campaigning takes place, and then the other 40 or so get completely ignored year after year because, you know, everybody knows how California is going to vote, everybody knows how North Dakota is going to vote, and so on.
But let me ask you, that's a recent development. When I go back and look at our history, if you go back even to the 50s and the 40s and the 30s, many of these elections were won by 10% of the vote, and states were not as rigid in terms of their populations where you knew expressly that California would go for Democrats and Wyoming was always going to go for Republicans. So this is a relatively recent development, is it not?
There have traditionally been swing states and safe states, but it is much more rigid today than it was in the past. And that's something we've seen in all areas of election. It's very closely tied to the degrees of political polarization that we have today. If you're somebody who typically votes Republican, it would be quite a remarkable thing for somebody to convince you to vote for Hillary Clinton in the presidential election. And vice versa. It would be very difficult to convince somebody that typically votes Democratic to vote for Donald Trump in the presidential election. And as a result, states overall become more and more predictable year after year. And we have seen a decline in the number of swing states most election cycles.
Now, the national popular vote, just for those who are listening, does not come as an outgrowth of the 2016 election. This predates it. So the idea that Donald Trump lost by 3 million votes, that this is a Democratic ruse in order just to propagate a whole different approach to the way we count these votes. Because we've had other presidents like Bill Clinton, who never got a majority. He was always a plurality. And we've seen other elections like, Bush and Gore. So this predates him. But tell us where this national popular vote movement is today, because it's state-based and it's not amending the Constitution, though I know that Fair Vote would like to do both, a compact among the states and a constitutional change. Explain that.
Sure. So the National Popular Vote Bill, as I mentioned, states are free to award their electors however they choose. And so they've always had the right to say, you know what, our electors are not going to go necessarily to the candidate who wins the most votes in our state. They're going to go to the candidate who wins the most votes in all 50 states, to the National Popular Vote winner. And so what the National Popular Vote Bill is an agreement among states that they will all agree to do that together. It does not go into effect until enough states have passed it so that that candidate will be guaranteed to win the presidential election. So enough states so that their electoral votes are a majority of all of the electoral votes. At this point, 11 states have passed the National Popular Vote Bill. They have collectively 165 electoral votes, which means that it's about two-thirds of the way there. All of those states, by the way, passed it before the 2016 election. So you're right, this really can't be described as a reaction to the 2016 election. It's not a partisan issue at all, really. Democrats win the national popular vote at about the same rate that Republicans win the national popular vote. Republicans can win nationwide elections, and they do win nationwide elections. In fact, if you look back at 2004, there you've got an election where George W. Bush had a clear lead in the national popular vote, but had John Kerry managed to swing just a few thousand votes in Ohio, he would have won the Electoral College despite losing the national popular vote by a sizable margin. So it affects both parties. It's really a system that takes us from a situation where the voters in swing states are the ones that matters, the voters in safe states don't, and puts us in a situation where every vote is actually equal. Every vote matters equally and will be sought by the candidates equally.
Well, some say that this will favor the large states with huge populations, and some believe that the Electoral College system, the way it's emerged, has been there as a bulwark against the small states not having any say in our elections. Explain to us why you feel that's not the case.
Yeah, well, small states can't really be said to have an advantage under the Electoral College system. After all, most of the small states are safe for one party or the other, and so most of the small states are completely ignored in every presidential election. Under a national popular vote, they would receive as much campaign attention as is proportional to the size of their population, essentially, because every voter in those small states would actually matter. Now, the issue about big states versus small states does come down to, ultimately, a kind of misunderstanding about just how big states are and just how small states are. You'll hear a similar concern about urban areas versus rural areas, that if a candidate could potentially win by only winning urban areas. And it's just not the case that enough of the country lives in California or enough of the country lives in urban areas. And it's also not the case that they all vote the same way. So those scenarios really aren't practical. If you actually look at the numbers, let's take California, for example. California has, if you look at the percent of the voters in the 2016 election that voted in California, it's actually lower than the percent of electoral votes that California has. So California has more influence in terms of percent of votes that it has under the Electoral College system than it would under the national popular vote. But under the current system, all of those votes reliably go to Democrats, whereas under a national popular vote, they would be divided. You know, something more than a third of them probably would go to the Republican year after year. And so Republicans would have every incentive to go out to California and try to campaign for more of those votes. Same with the other large states that are completely ignored today. Texas, for example, the second largest state by population in the union. Democrats have largely no incentive to campaign there today. They would under a national popular vote. And then you look at the small states that are completely ignored today, whether you're looking at a blue state like Vermont or a red state like Wyoming or North Dakota or whatever, those states get completely ignored today. Under a national popular vote, their votes would matter equally with everyone else.
Well, let me ask you, there are a lot of people who say, well, this is unenforceable because if a Sarah Palin or a Ted Cruz came out with the larger, you know, proportion of the popular vote, would a New York or a California really swing their votes if they voted in the opposite manner to that state, or would they just break this compact?
A compact is a contract. It's a binding contract between the states, and the states would be required to follow the dictates of the compact. Now, you can, of course, leave the compact, but the compact dictates that you can't do that after the votes have been cast, but before the electoral votes have been cast. So that wouldn't be an option for the state any more than if their population voted in a way different from the majority party in the state legislature today. You know, like the North Carolina state legislature is overwhelmingly Republican, but North Carolina is actually a swing state. If North Carolina were to vote for a Democrat in 2020, the North Carolina state legislature couldn't just say, you know what, actually, I think the electors should go to the Republican. That would be something that would be seen as a violation of
the right. But let me ask you, the long term, I mean, if that happened in California, as I just described, don't you think they'd back out for the next election if this were not codified in some other way? And is a better challenge to all of this perhaps the violation of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause? Because based on weighting of the Electoral College, if you look at Wyoming, it's got a population of about 585,000. They have 3 electoral votes. California, which has about 39 million people, 55 electoral votes. So you're really giving weight to Wyoming 3.6 times more than each vote in California. Isn't that perhaps a better tack to take to challenge the Electoral College?
Yeah, that has been tried, actually, testing it in court that way. Not successfully. The Electoral College is spelled out specifically in the Constitution, and it's clear that states do have the right to award their electors however they choose. It's also not something that really resonates with people that well, although you'll hear that argument sometimes that Wyoming has this mathematical superiority over California. But of course, the reality is that the voters in Wyoming and the voters in California, their votes count equally, which is to say, not at all. Those are both safe states. The campaigns don't bother going there and asking for their votes because they know exactly how the state's going to go year after year.
But are we really talking about visitation? Because a lot of people visit the state that we are emanating from, Connecticut, but they come here just to get money and leave. Mm-hmm. So are we looking for visitation or a fairer way to select a president?
No, you want visitation. When I talk about campaigning there, that's really a shorthand for how much the person's votes there actually count. So the question is, is your vote one that actually will have an opportunity to swing the election? Like, mm-hmm. To what extent is that, you know, it's always a statistical thing and the chances are always low, but in a lot of states it's essentially zero. Enough that the campaigns aren't even bothering to seek your votes. Now, you're right, of course, the candidates do go to California and New York and Connecticut and so on for fundraising, but they don't go there to actually seek the votes of the voters there, which suggests something about what kind of power those votes actually have.
There's another argument against the National Popular Vote Initiative, which is the recount question and whether, in fact, it's realistic to be able to recount all across America if, in fact, we have a problem like the Chads, the hanging Chads in Florida several years ago. Tell us how you respond to that.
Sure. So the principal point is that recounts would be almost impossible to need to occur under a National Popular Vote Plan. The reason is because we actually do a good deal of research into recounts, and what we show is that the margin by which a recount can change the outcome decreases more and more the larger pool of voters there are. So if you break the country up into 50 separate elections, it's very plausible that you'll wind up having to conduct a recount in one of them. And of course, in 2016, recounts were sought in 3 states. Recounts were sought in 2004. And of course, the very high-profile recount in Florida in the year 2000. But none of those states were close enough to where there would have been a recount at the national level. On top of that, the National Popular Vote Plan, as I mentioned, does not abolish the Electoral College system. So the voting is still done in a decentralized state-by-state manner, and any recounts that needed to occur would also be done in a state-by-state recount, state-by-state manner. So there's a bill, in fact, that is in the book that National Popular Vote puts out. It's a book called Every Vote Equal, that recommends that Congress pass a bill that would basically ensure that every state have the ability to conduct a recount if the campaign is willing to pay for it, something that's not true now. Even, you know, 17 years after the 2000 election, we still have not put smooth recount procedures into anywhere near all 50 states.
The Electoral College under this plan, it's not eliminated, but explain how it would be different than the way we see it conducted today.
Yeah, so the reason the Electoral College would still be an important institution under National Popular Vote is because it would allow the voting and the vote counting and that whole process to continue to be a decentralized state-by-state system. So you're not having a system where the federal government is running the election. And in some ways, it's an incremental step. So you mentioned that fair vote does actually favor a constitutional amendment. There are lots of, and I want to be clear that There are lots of people who favor national popular vote who do not favor a constitutional amendment. There are reasons why you might favor the former but not the latter. Mm-hmm. But one is that it is sort of a conservative approach. It retains a lot of the decentralized nature of our election administration system that you have under the current system, but it also ensures that the candidate who wins the most votes in all 50 states will be the one that wins the presidency.
Drew Penrose is with us from fairvote.org. You folks like proportional representation and rank voting and the like. There are some who think that maybe the better approach to mending our presidential selection process is to go the way of Maine and Nebraska, where they have electors selected by the winner of each congressional district. So there's a certain proportionality. So they would still come into the state because there are still electoral votes to be gained. Why is that not a better method here to mend it rather than end it, per se?
Sure. So first of all, it's hard to get states to adopt that, and that is something where a state would have to do it unilaterally. Unlike the National Popular Vote Plan, where it's a bunch of states collectively doing it together to ensure one national result, you can have a situation where if some states do it and others don't, you wind up with a situation that's very, very unfair. On the other hand, if you could somehow get every state to do it, for example, by constitutional amendment, then if we consider the two things that people think are problems with the current system, that is, one is uncompetitive states, so safe states and swing states, and the other is the possibility that a candidate could win despite losing the most votes nationwide, both of those problems would be worse under a congressional district system. So if we think that there are too many safe states today, ask yourself how many safe congressional districts there are. The answer is far more. There are actually 87% of the congressional districts that we can call 2 years in advance of the 2018 election. You're getting upwards of 90% of the population of the country being in a place where there's no competition. We don't want to import that system into the presidential election. And then in terms of one candidate winning the most votes but losing the electors, you could even have that happen under the congressional district system at all as well. In fact, if you look back at 2012, Democrats won more votes in congressional districts overall, mm-hmm. but Republicans still won a majority of the House of Representatives in 2012. It's not a system that creates a one-to-one fit between votes.
With the gerrymandering that goes on today. What about the notion that if we did it by popular vote, and we know that Bill Clinton, just going back to the year that he ran against George H.W. Bush, and then, of course, we had another gentleman, Ross Perot, in the race. He got 19%. And if the parties themselves are weakening or beginning to fracture, and maybe you've got more moderate Democrat, a more liberal Democrat, a more conservative versus more populist Republican, and then you've got people who say, well, wait a minute, if all I have to do is win the plurality of votes, without perhaps having a runoff at the end between one and two, then we could have some fringe candidates who emerge with 27% of the vote or 38% of the vote. And, how do you account for that in this popular vote effort?
Yeah, so the idea that a candidate wins just by getting the most votes, not necessarily a majority of the votes, is the way that most elections are done in the United States today. It's the way that most states elect their governors, for example. And you do sometimes wind up with a situation where a candidate wins with less than 50% of the vote. Now, it's usually not the situation you described where some fringe candidate wins with 28% of the vote. Usually it's more like, for example, the situation they've had in Maine where they have a strong independent streak, and as a result, a candidate can win. Usually it's a Republican or a Democrat, but a candidate can win in Maine for the governor's seat with as little as like 38% of the vote, which is what the current governor, Paul LePage, won in his first election. That is one of the reasons why Fair Vote would prefer a constitutional amendment ultimately, because the National Popular Vote Plan only is capable of awarding the presidency to the candidate with the plurality of votes, not necessarily a majority. But let's not make the perfect the enemy of the good. No one in these states where candidates can win with a plurality of the vote is suggesting that the state adopt some sort of county-by-county electoral college method in order to address that problem. The better way of addressing it is through something like a runoff system or through ranked choice voting, which is something that we
So would you like to see that in America? If we ended up with seven people running and the highest total was 32, would you like the two top candidates to have a runoff if, in fact, we did amend the Constitution?
That would be one way of doing it. That's essentially what France does to elect its president right now. Runoff elections, however, tend to be very expensive. They extend the campaign period even longer, raising campaign finance issues, and turnout in runoffs often drops pretty considerably. And that's one of the reasons why we prefer ranked choice voting, which is sometimes called instant runoff voting. It lets you get the benefits of a runoff election in a single round by just asking you who your second choice is. And that way, if that candidate doesn't, if your first choice doesn't make the runoff, your ballot can just count for your second choice. So that's really the system that we think will be the future of single winner elections in the United States, and probably the one we would pick for the presidential election in the long term.
In closing, Drew, where do you think this national popular vote movement is going over the next year or two? Is there a determination that perhaps enough states can be enlisted in this effort to make it operational for 2020? Is that possible?
Well, it is already two-thirds of the way there. Now, the group that is pushing for it is called National Popular Vote, and that's not us, right? That's a different organization. So I don't have an inside look into what their tactics are or what they see as realistic. The rate at which it's been going has been pretty good. It did pass a number of legislative chambers last year and the year before. So I do see the momentum continuing. I don't know if I would put money on 2020, but 2024, I might.
Drew Penrose from fairvote.org, I can't thank you enough for being with us today and describing something that people may have gotten a glimpse of or heard about, but don't really understand. You've really gone into the weeds with us, and we do appreciate it.
Thanks. It was great.